You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to an Oneida Nation councilman about efforts to produce hemp and whether it could be its new cash crop. First, overshadowed by the coronavirus, racial tension, and other news, the U.S. is taking new steps aimed at punishing China for its treatment of Hong Kong. Early last week, in a rushed and secretive process, China imposed a new security law that pretty much gives it unchecked legal power over the territory. China says it's needed to protect Hong Kong's economic development and political stability. Hong Kong residents and many in the international community say the law gets rid of any remaining autonomy Hong Kong had had under Chinese rule. In response, the U.S. House and Senate both passed bills penalizing China and those who do business with China. That's on top of moves the Trump administration had taken since the end of May. And that's on top of other areas of friction between Washington and Beijing. John Ruich is a reporter for NPR who covers China and Hong Kong. John, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for the invitation.
Before we get into the latest developments, John, can you describe for us this kind of unusual status that Hong Kong had had within China?
Sure. So the history is actually important here. And this is the issue that we're talking about is very fundamentally rooted in the history. And it goes back almost 200 years to when Britain took over Hong Kong as a colony in 1842. The territory that Britain held expanded. In 1898, it took over an area called the New Territories, which is across Victoria Harbor from the island of Hong Kong. And if you fast forward 99 years from that, you get 1997, which is when Hong Kong was returned to China with pomp and circumstance on July 1st. The key is that in preparation for that return from Britain to China, China and the UK signed a joint declaration in 1984 that laid out the terms of Hong Kong's handover. And the key parts were, number one, that Hong Kong would be under a governance model called One Country, Two Systems, where the one country is China and the two systems are the mainland and Hong Kong, which drives on the other side of the road, has its own money, sets its own monetary policy, has independent courts, etc. And the second part is that Hong Kong was promised a high degree of autonomy for 50 years, basically that the Hong Kong government would get to manage its own affairs except for defense and foreign policy. And so that's sort of been the bone of contention here. There's been a sense in Hong Kong, even before this law was passed, that Beijing has been increasingly encroaching on its affairs in ways that it promised it wouldn't do under the joint declaration. And that's fueled protests over the years that last year boiled over into months and months of sometimes huge and sometimes violent demonstrations against this encroachment of Beijing's will on Hong Kong and against the government there.
And from the American perspective, the U.S. has treated Hong Kong differently in significant ways, including trade, right? What kind of things might we allow with Hong Kong that we wouldn't with the rest of China?
Yeah, exactly. So as the U.S. saw the handover coming in 1992, we codified in law that we would continue to treat Hong Kong as a separate entity from China in many ways, arguably the most important being trade. As you mentioned, there's billions of dollars worth of trade done between the two each year. The United States is Hong Kong's second biggest trading partner. Around 1,300 U.S. businesses operate out of Hong Kong and make it the regional hub. So for U.S. businesses and Western businesses, it's an important toehold in Asia. It's also been critical to the development of Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong for American businesses has been attractive in large part because it's of its access to China, but it's a place where there has been rule of law, independent courts, freedoms that aren't in existence in the mainland. That gave Western businesses a lot of confidence. But trade is probably the biggest area of difference between the two, between China and Hong Kong, between the way that we treat them. Hong Kong is its own, is considered its own customs territory separate from China. So there's a trade war on right now with China, tariffs on Chinese goods. If they're exported out of Hong Kong, there's no tariffs on them.
We're talking to John Ruich from NPR, looking at the U.S. response to China's crackdown in Hong Kong. John, what are the key things you've seen out of Congress and the president in response to China's actions now in Hong Kong?
Yeah, good question. I mean, the Trump, when China signaled in May that it was going ahead with this national security law, the Trump administration took steps to roll back the special status that Hong Kong has with the United States. I mean, the U.S. relationship with Hong Kong was premised on the city having sufficient autonomy from China. And Trump administration in late May said no longer. That is not the case. So they're rolling back special trade status, taking actions against officials deemed to be linked to the erosion of freedoms in Hong Kong. The State Department even issued new travel advice on Hong Kong, which had been seen as one of the freest, safest, most open places on earth, really. And Congress has taken action as well. You know, Congress last year during the protests passed the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which was enacted in November by Trump. And that requires annual certification by the State Department of Hong Kong's autonomy. And it requires that they make recommendations on suggested courses of action. Congress has now also passed a sanctions bill early this month that would force sanctions on Chinese officials, and it threatens foreign banks that do business that supports Beijing's crackdown on Hong Kong.
How important is Hong Kong for China's economy and its financial system?
Yeah, Hong Kong at the time in 1984 when the joint declaration was negotiated, and certainly in 1997 when Britain handed it over, you know, Hong Kong was, it made a lot of sense for China to implement one country, two systems there, because Hong Kong was a huge part of the economy of China. It was a much bigger portion than it is now. And a large portion of trade from China flowed through Hong Kong than it does now. Those numbers have changed. On the financial side, though, Hong Kong is a key conduit for hard money, basically for capital raising for Chinese firms and for access to dollars.
Is there any sign that what we've seen from the U.S. so far, the actions you just mentioned, is moving China away from this policy at all?
Good question. When China signaled that it was going ahead with this national security law in May, not only the U.S., but European countries, even Japan, some other countries around the world made it known that this would be a bad move, that it was a violation in their eyes of the joint declaration of Hong Kong's mini constitution, which is called the Basic Law. China basically ignored it. They were uncowed. They went ahead with the law. They even, when it was finally made public on the day that it was passed and ratified, people who had been paying close attention to it felt that the wording was even harsher, even more draconian than they had expected. So far, at least in the run-up to the imposition of this law, U.S. pressure and pressure from outside hasn't had much effect. We'll see what happens with implementation going forward, though.
There's so much going on. You touched on this already. We already have a long-running now trade dispute with China. On top of that, human rights concerns about largely Muslim minority populations in parts of China. And of course, the president blaming China for the spread of COVID-19. This is one more item on a long list of pretty big trouble spots between the two countries.
No doubt. Relations between China and the U.S. seem to be in a free fall. And every day, you pointed out four or five items there. Every day, there seems to be something new that's setting the relationship back. Experts that follow this and have followed it for a long time say the situation is as bad or worse than it's been at any time since 1989, when China rolled the army and tanks into central Beijing to quell protests there.
With all of this going on, what are you watching for next between the U.S. and China?
Yeah, I mean, on this law in particular, it'll be interesting to watch how China implements it, whether they take a really hard line on it or whether or not they're very selective with who they persecute under this. I mean, there have been several people arrested already. There have been some protests in Hong Kong. At least in one case, a person had a Hong Kong independence flag and was arrested under this law the day that it was implemented. So we'll be watching to see that. We're watching to see if banks and officials are going to get roped into sanctions here because of what's happened in Hong Kong, and whether or not that's going to lead ultimately to a flight of foreign business from there. On another issue, Britain, Taiwan, Australia, they've all offered a pathway out of Hong Kong for Hong Kongers who don't feel safe there under this new law. And the U.S. is considering a similar type of action. China's not happy about it, but are we going to see an exodus? Is there going to be a brain drain? I mean, that's a longer term issue. That's something to keep an eye on for sure.
We will watch that along with you, John. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Ruich is a reporter for NPR who covers China and Hong Kong. We talked to them about the Trump administration's approach to the region after China passed a law cracking down on protesters in Hong Kong. Coming up, we talked to a tribal councilman about the United Nations plans to move forward on hemp production. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a unity task force assembled by former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders came out with its recommendations for the Democratic nominee's platform. We'll look at where compromises were made and what it means for the next few months of campaigning. First, the United Nations is testing out whether hemp production can boost the tribal economy. Their budgets rely heavily on casinos for revenue. Casinos have taken a hit, like many other businesses, as the coronavirus pandemic continues to slow things down. Like many farmers experimenting with hemp in Wisconsin, last year's harvest didn't go quite according to plan, but the tribe says it's learned valuable lessons to make this year more successful. Ernie Stevens III is a tribal councilman with the United Nations. He coordinated the tribe's venture into hemp production. Ernie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you talk about what led the tribe into pursuing hemp production now that it's more legal than it used to be?
Well, we've always thought of it as an important commodity, as a natural resource. You know, it was very, very prominent in the state of Wisconsin for many years before the paper industry really took over. So a lot of communities, tribes, entities utilized it. And so a part of it was just logic. You know, it's a better product. It could be utilized for forestry. You know, it has the same decarbonization as trees, but in a much more expedited fashion. So there's a number of natural resource usages for hemp. So as tribal communities, we always look for ways to work with the environment and to improve the environment. So it was always based on that. But then, you know, we always looked at the economic opportunity as well to utilize it to, you know, replace plastics, to replace other forms that are just better on the environment and also more efficient and ultimately could be an economic opportunity and venture in a long-term basis. So a number of those reasons and more that we've always for some time seen hemp as a viable opportunity to improve our community.
As you mentioned, there's a lot of different kinds of products that involve hemp, and as I understand it, kind of different ways of growing them and harvesting them. What kind of products, what kind of markets have you been focusing on so far?
Well, a big one is the utilization of car parts, like filters and things like that. I mean, there's a mass manufacture opportunity if we can provide the hemp to replace different forms of again, paper is another big one. So anything involving paper and plastic to provide a more biodegradable option that also is more economically feasible in the onset of purchasing and acquisition and all those things. I mean, anything involving replacing those pieces of the supply chains is a good thing. But of course, you know, the big one right now too is hempcrete. To find more efficient ways to build buildings, supply buildings with different components, filtering and just different aspects of building, whether it's residential or commercial buildings. There's a lot of opportunity for hemp to replace. And again, it's always about efficiency. It's always about environmental impact. And hemp provides that opportunity. Both an environmental fashion as well as an economic fashion. So those are a few things that we've looked at when it comes to hemp, and it's specific to hemp fiber. So it's there's a number of different varieties of and forms of hemp But we're focused specifically on the fiber version of hemp.
And I know there's interest in all those CBD products out there on the market. Is that something you've been experimenting with too, growing hemp? And I understand that is a very different type of farming than growing hemp for fiber.
Yeah, last year the CBD was we had a significant portion of our grow was involved in CBD. We purchased seeds that were cultivated in a whole different climate, so I think that resulted in a really expedited development for the product. You know, so it ended up going hot, as they say. In other words, you know, the 0.3 a THC count is a legal limit. So if it gets 0.3 or above, it's considered a controlled substance. You know, and again, a lot of people who understand these aspects, they don't agree with that. I mean, the number should be a lot higher. I certainly am one that feels, you know, it's 0.3% is not a threshold of controlled substance, but it's federal law. But that's the big difference. You know, with our fiber product last year, we just weren't able to harvest it. You know, our particular location was really wet. We couldn't get the equipment in to harvest it. So it's really a totally different situation when it comes to how you manage the product. You know, and so CBD is a totally different thing. It's mm-hmm. It's very similar to what you would see in a marijuana operation. It smells just like it. You know, I mean, when you sell it, you know, in the shops, a lot of it is oils and the tinctures, but sometimes they do sell the smokable product that looks just like marijuana, but again, it just doesn't have the THC count. And again, it's a legality piece of it, so people, when they sell it, it smells just the same, but again, it's a highly medicinal usage. So we were interested in that. We just didn't, you know, we didn't have much success with it. And it's a very saturated market right now, but we're still very interested, but we're not utilizing it at this point.
We're talking to Ernie Stevens, the third tribal councilman with the Oneida Nation, talking about the tribe's ventures into hemp production here in Wisconsin. Ernie, I know a lot of farmers who tried hemp last year in Wisconsin ran into some similar problems. Are there lessons learned? Are there reasons to think that this year things are going to come out better than they did last year?
Well, I think the biggest lesson learned is just being able to, I mean, it's all about resiliency, you know, being able to adapt to your climate, you know, and our climate is changing. No matter what people think about it, the climate is changing, specific to the Midwest. It's going to be a lot wetter. It's adjusting. So it's adjusting to the climate changes that we're dealing with. And so that's a very important piece. Anybody who understands agronomy and you know, monitoring agricultural products, like specific to, you know, hemp itself, as well as any, other byproducts like cover crops that you use to you know, rebuild the soil. Climate is so important about that. So I think that's one of the most important learning curves that people have to go through, is understanding how these crops do in this particular climate. And I think fiber, in comparison to, you know, CBD. CBD is an indoor product. I think we'll have to be honest about that. Similar to marijuana, it has to be grown indoor, has to be monitored on a daily basis. So it's a totally different situation. Fiber is more resilient on its own as an individual crop that can adjust and be managed alongside other weeds and other crops that might grow around it. So it's more natural. A form of hemp, and I think so that's probably the most important learning curve, is just understanding the differences and management of the crop and letting it grow, you know, letting it be natural, not having to over monitor, over manage it, letting it, you know, grow naturally, but also just understanding that it grows fast and develops fast, and just being able to just really monitor it. I think that's the most important learning curve.
And Ernie, I understand this is part of an effort to kind of diversify the tribal economy. You take it a hit, as I mentioned up front, casinos like restaurants and a lot of other venues hit hard by COVID-19. Can you talk about the importance of diversifying?
Yeah, I mean, tribal community specifically, you know, we always have a goal of providing programs and services to our communities, you know, our tribal membership. And so gaming's been able to really provide a lot of that, you know, and by funding different programs and services, healthcare, education, all these things that are really amazing and wonderful opportunities for tribal members. But like, as the pandemic has shown us, you know, it's you know, when you shut down a casino, you're facing some significant, you know, income loss on a daily basis. And that those are incomes that go directly towards those programs, again, daily, weekly, monthly. And so it's a really major issue when your operations aren't operating, you're not bringing in revenue. And so economic diversification has always been a concern and issue for at least Oneida and, of course, several other tribes. It's a goal. It's something that we want to be able to create a revenue stream. Again, it's very difficult to have a revenue stream similar to gaming, but to be able to do that in a similar fashion, to be able to do, you know, provide some kind of diversified income. I mean, we want multiple forms of income. So to be able to do that, that's a goal for several tribes. And of course, Oneida. And we saw hemp as a viable opportunity to do that.
Ernie, sorry about that. Thanks a lot for joining us today. We'll leave it there.
Okay. Thanks for the time.
That's Ernie Stevens III, tribal councilman with the Oneida Nation. He coordinated the tribe's experiments with hemp and brought us up to date on how they're doing with that this season. Coming up, we'll look at what a Democratic Unity Task Force is recommending to the party's likely nominee for issues like healthcare, climate change, and more. And you can weigh in with what you want to hear from the presidential candidates of either party. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 8 on the morning show, job losses mean that a lot of people have also lost health coverage. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at options for health coverage access here in Wisconsin. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a unity task force put together by former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders is out with its policy recommendations for the Democratic Party's presumptive nominee. The group was assembled in May with different committees focused on climate change, criminal justice, healthcare, immigration, the economy, and education. The task force's 110 pages of policy ideas aren't official, but could put pressure on likely nominee Joe Biden. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What issues do you want to see presidential candidates talking about over the next few months? What will sway your vote? What specific things do you want to hear about? Healthcare, COVID-19, economic recovery, the environment, you name it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy to be with you, Rob.
Well, I want to talk about this process of this unity group here, this kind of high-profile effort to say, hey, people from the Senator Sanders camp and the Vice President Biden camp coming together, hashing out some policy ideas. Why is this important for the Democratic Party to do?
Well, I think that what we've seen, you know, historically, if you look back at the Democrats, this goes back decades and decades, where you have a more liberal or progressive wing, and then you have a more moderate wing, and depending on which wing's preferred candidate gets the presidential nomination, let's say if we're talking about presidential politics, what you find is that there are attempts to incorporate ideas from the other wing of the party, and at the same time there are demands from the other wing of the party to have their ideas included. And so what this task force did was really come together in a much more formalized way than I think we've seen in the past to look at what some of those policy divides are on some of the key issues that most Democrats would identify as their key issues, and then try to come out with a document that brought the two groups together in a way that would ideally, from the party's perspective, make both sides happy.
There's been some speculation that, okay, is this going to move Biden, perceived as a moderate, further to the left? But on some key areas, it's not Medicare for All recommended here. It's a public option, like was discarded very early in the Obamacare negotiations. There's environmental targets and climate change targets, but not Green New Deal. When it comes to that center versus left continuum, how do you see this all shaking out?
You know, it's interesting because the two things you referenced, Medicare for All and Green New Deal, were two very important. I was going to call them buzzwords, but I don't want to call them buzzwords. But they were two very important ideas that were, you know, put out there by the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And so the absence of those terms and some of the core principles that they embody, I think it stands out to people, absolutely, because those are things that were talked about quite a bit during the nomination phase of the campaign. And so, as you said, what we're seeing, if we think about healthcare, is not Medicare for All, but instead this idea of the public option, which has been something that, you know, Biden has talked about previously and what he committed to during the nomination phase. There is a broader role for Medicare. The age to enroll in Medicare would be lowered. So there were some concessions in that regard. If we think about the Green New Deal and the fact that itself wasn't included in its entirety, there are some pretty bold policies recommended in there in regard to climate change. So, for example, setting a national goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 for all new buildings. So that's a pretty substantial thing to put out there. I think that where Biden is moving to the left most considerably would be on some of the economic policies that were put forward and that he further spoke about in a speech yesterday in regard to ideas about job security and other things related to investments in infrastructure and things like that. So that's where he's trying to, move along the mantle, I guess, from FDR and those who have taken it up from that perspective. And that's where I think we saw the furthest move to the left.
And that economic policy you mentioned also calls for, you know, putting more of American investment into American-produced products. So government, federal spending, trying to guarantee that it goes to American manufacturers. Some people have read that as kind of an economic populist message, trying to draw away some key voters in some key states, manufacturing states like Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Do you read it that way?
Well, I do. And I also would remind people that if we think back to the Democratic Party 30, 40 years ago, they were the party of Made in America. And they came along on free trade and things like that. They were brought along on those policies by the Republicans. And so it's not necessarily something new. I think this idea of supporting American workers and American jobs has always been key to the Democrats' agenda going back again to the New Deal.
Talking to Susan Johnson, political scientist at UW-Whitewater, looking at this unity platform brought together by Biden and Bernie Sanders supporters, and more generally, policy issues in this 2020 presidential race. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What issues do you want to see debated? What policies do you want to see either candidate bring forward? 800-642-1234. Susan, I saw this New York Times Siena College poll. They asked Bernie Sanders supporters, they support Biden 87-4 over Trump, Elizabeth Warren supporters 96-0 over Trump, which you'd expect, you know, they're all theoretically Democrats. But there was that concern from 2016 among Democrats that, you know, some Bernie Sanders supporters, you know, voted for someone other than Hillary Clinton or didn't vote. Does it look different to you this time around?
It does. And I will say, I remember I was on with you in the winter as the nomination process was coming to an end, and we took calls, and many of the callers were Sanders supporters who said that they would never vote for Joe Biden. So I think that part of the reason why this task force was put together is to, from the Democratic Party's perspective, hopefully get some of those people who were adamant that they would never support Biden to see that Biden has reached out to Sanders, and that Sanders supporters in political office and the like are having a say in what the Biden campaign is going to be speaking about as we get going in the fall campaign. That didn't happen in 2016. It was a much more acrimonious, I would say, relationship between Biden and Hillary Clinton. I'm sorry, between Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And that carried on through the election. And I think it was really smart from the Democratic Party's perspective to push really hard early so that this, hopefully, from their perspective, would get resolved before the convention and before we get to the post-Labor Day push for the general election.
Susan Johnson is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. We're talking about the recommendations of a Democratic Unity Task Force with progressives and moderates working on policy suggestions for the party's nominee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You can join in about that, or more generally, what issues do you want to see on the table in this presidential race? What is going to swing your vote, if there's anything left that could swing your vote at this point? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, looking at the work of a Democratic Unity Task Force and wider policy issues in the presidential race. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you lean toward the Democratic side, do you think the party should go big on ideas like Medicare for All and a Green New Deal? Or do you like more moderate compromise positions? If you're looking at this from the Republican side, what do you want to hear from President Trump as he kicks his side of the campaign into high gear? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been watching the Democratic Party for a long time now, and they really have moved so far to the left that I don't even know if Barack Obama in 08, based on the platform that he ran on, would have been the nominee. So I do wonder who these moderates are. It appears a moderate is someone who just doesn't want to move as fast. So they all want Medicare for all. It's just that the moderates say, we can't get there yet. We need a stepping stone to get there. Who are the moderates?
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. And Susan, first of all, Steve's premise, the Democratic Party moving to the left.
I would say that clearly what we're seeing is that there is a very vocal activist wing of the party that has received a lot of attention and is clearly working very hard to move the party to the left. There's no doubt about it. What we saw with the nomination, however, is that the party coalesced around the more moderate candidate. And we can debate, what moderate means as far as a Democrat, because that can be a moving target, just like conservative. I mean, we could flip this around and talk about conservatives, and many would argue that there's no such thing as a moderate conservative anymore either. So what I would say is that when we looked at who the voters were and who the voters chose as their nominee, they chose the candidate that was less liberal, let's say, or less to the left. And that's been fairly consistent. Hillary Clinton would have been more moderate than Bernie Sanders, if we're thinking about it, relatively speaking. And then again, Barack Obama was more, people don't necessarily see it this way, but the fact is that Hillary Clinton in 2008 was more liberal than he was.
Thanks a lot for that call, Steve, at 800-642-1234. I want to turn to the Republican side of things now. Is the process different for an incumbent who has four close to 4 years now behind them. Is it a matter of them saying, here are my priorities for the next 4 years, or trying to make a case for their accomplishments from the last 4 years?
Generally speaking, when you're running for reelection, you're doing a couple of different things. You're not as much focusing on new ideas, but instead building on the accomplishments that you've already had over your first 4 years. I would say that we're in such a unique environment with COVID-19 and how much of a focus that has become, rightly so. And so, it's difficult, I would say, for both the Republicans and the Democrats to get attention paid to things that are not necessarily related to, I would say, COVID-19. And then within the last 6 weeks or so, the issues regarding racial justice and policies like that.
Let's bring on another caller now. Jerry is with us in Iron Mountain, Michigan. Jerry, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Jerry?
I want to talk about the Medicare for All. I think the Democrats, even though I support Medicare for All, Democrats need to go a little bit light on that and just push for possibly, the option like you were talking about. If more people like myself in their 50s, late 50s, had access to affordable health care, they could retire early and give these good-paying jobs to the younger people instead of them having minimum wage-type service jobs. Also, I want to comment on Republicans. Back in the day, the Republicans had this contract for America, or contract with America, that they ran on quite a few years ago, and I don't know whatever happened to that. I think it kind of fell on its face. Maybe someone could do some research on that.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Not going to dig into that now, but can we talk a little more about what came out of this Unity platform, again, not Medicare for All, but that public option? Again, this is not official Biden platform here, but what kind of things are they kicking around here, Susan?
So, sure. There would be a public option, which would be administered by Medicare, and it would allow people who are not eligible for Medicaid, okay, and anyone else who wants a public option from the Affordable Care Act exchanges. And if anyone was currently getting their health insurance from employers, they could also be eligible as well. And, I mean, it's basically the idea that the government is providing you with these different options as far as getting your health care, as opposed to private insurance, or as opposed to being limited to what an employer provides if that employer provides health insurance for its employees. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the age to enroll in Medicare would be lowered from 65 to 60. So, I mean, you know, Jerry makes a really good point about the fact that there are a lot of people out there who are financially comfortable and would retire if not for the issue of employer-based health care. And the only way for many people to get affordable, I'm putting affordable in quotes, but affordable health care is if they stay employed. And potentially, if there was something that was more of a public option, or if the age to enroll in Medicare was lowered to 60, I really think Jerry's right that you would see a lot of people leave the workforce, open up jobs for younger people, and move on to their retirement. And so I think that that's something that Jerry's right about.
Thanks for that call, Jerry. Susan, we just have a minute left. Sorry to the other callers remaining on the line, but are you hopeful that we can have good, solid, substantive policy debates over the course of the next few months?
Not really, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you, Rob, and
sure,
your listeners. We are so focused on, like I said, COVID-19 and the, just how negative all of politics has become of late. I think that this is a very good first step, but I think that we'll have to see to what extent the president wants to have these kinds of policy conversations as well.
Susan, thanks as always for joining us today.
Happy to do it. Have a good weekend, Rob.
You too. That's Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. She joined us for a look at the presidential race, including recommendations from a Democratic Unity Task Force aimed at policy ideas for the party's likely presumptive nominee, Joe Biden. Protesters across Wisconsin have been marching for more than a month now, calling for changes to the state's criminal justice system and other measures aimed at curbing years of systemic racism. Several local governments have approved changes, but proposals aren't moving as quickly at the state capitol. Laurel White reports.
On June 1st, hundreds of protesters blocked John Nolan Drive, a major thoroughfare in Madison, for several hours. They chanted, they linked arms, they danced. And as the afternoon progressed, they hollowed out a circle in the middle of the crowd for speakers.
Mic check!
Mic check!
Mic check!
Mic check!
All power to the people!
All power to the people!
One of those speakers in the middle of the crowd was a young black man, a recent high school graduate, who said he was tired of politicians' lack of action.
Mayors, governors, everybody, we didn't talk for them. And they promised us so much.
He'd been marching in protests and attending community meetings since 2015, when black teenager Tony Robinson was killed by a Madison police officer. He says they were promised things would change, but nothing did.
We had somebody sit in our face and tell us what they was going to do, what they did, nothing.
Yeah! Yeah.
He said politicians shouldn't come to protesters anymore to tell them what they're going to do. He said this time, don't talk to him until it's done.
They are not alone in the fact that they feel alienated and ignored.
This is State Representative Lakeisha Myers of Milwaukee. She leads the state legislature's Black Caucus.
One thing I will say is that I do believe that this particular iteration of, you know, the civil rights movement, because that's exactly what it is, will be different.
The Black Caucus sent a letter to Governor Tony Evers in early June, asking him to call a special session of the legislature in response to the Black Lives Matter movement. The governor has yet to do so. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes has defended the governor's choice. He says it's because the GOP-controlled legislature could gavel in and out of the session without taking any action, just like they did for a special session on gun laws last year.
At this critical moment, I don't think it's a good idea to have them deliver another slap in the face to so many people who are calling for justice.
During a Capitol press conference in late June, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss criticized the governor for releasing a set of proposed bills related to criminal justice. The bills would do things like bar police from using chokeholds.
He never consulted the legislature. It wasn't a time for partisan politics. It's a time for people of goodwill to sit down and say, where can we find that common ground?
Voss said it's unlikely the legislature will meet again before the end of the year. He says it's more realistic for lawmakers to, quote, take the time to see what the answers are.
And I also think that we need to have real actions, right? It's not just about changing the names of Eskimo pies and all these things that seem like they're just virtue signaling.
State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald didn't respond to requests for comment about Senate negotiations or his support for action on bills this year. Myers says she and others are working on changes at the state level. They include plans to ban no-knock warrants, to encourage more diversity in state contractors, and to put a penalty in place for people who recklessly call police on people who aren't committing crimes. But Myers concedes they probably won't get votes until next year.
I think the more immediate impacts can happen in this particular movement at the county and the municipal level.
Change is happening at the local level. School districts have voted to remove police officers from schools. There's talk about cutting local police department budgets. Change in state government remains an afterthought, at least for now. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, it can be hard to juggle parenting and a job in normal times, and a guest says it's gotten way tougher during the COVID-19 pandemic. Find out why, and you can join in and share your experiences. After a long stretch where the Federal Election Commission was out of commission because of a shortage of commissioners, the FEC is out of action again in a big election year. We'll get the details. And a lot of people are out of work because of the COVID-19 outbreak, and it's hard to do in-person job fairs and resume trainings and that kind of thing. We're going to check out a new drive-in job fair happening here in Wisconsin. That and look at some of the top news of the day. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 7, State Senator Lena Taylor joins the show for a look at protests, police reform, and more. Join the conversation Monday at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then summer berries are in season right about now. We'll talk with a Ho-Chunk chef about how to track down wild berries and hear some of her favorite ways to use them. You can check out our recipe, a really yummy one, over at wpr.org/foodfriday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.